I was wondering if we can speak about life and death, those two phenomenons, and death being the counterpart of life. But first, there's a sutta, and it's called Fragile or Perishable. It says, Bhikkhus, I will teach you the fragile and the unfragile, the perishable and the unperishable. What is the fragile and what is the unfragile? Form is the fragile. Its cessation, subsiding, passing away is the unfragile. So feeling is the fragile. Perception is the fragile. Intentions are fragile. Consciousness is fragile. Their cessation, subsiding, passing away is unfragile, unperishable. That fact of their change remains. So those things, those particular things, change in various ways. They're subject to change, but one thing that is not up for debate or subject to change is that they're ending. So in terms of, like, we have the phenomenon of life. And its counterpart. So here's life, everything that I'm experiencing now. The all, if I can say that. Myself included. Everything. And the background to that is this change, is this death.
You gotta understand death as the background of death is implicit. So, because it's usually like death is perceived to be something at the end of the life.
Yeah.
Like when that time comes, then death will arrive, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But actually death is already here through the fact that you were manifested, that you were born. Already implies, as we say often, like the manifestation of a thing, anything, any phenomenon, big or small, far or near, doesn't matter. Manifestation of a thing is its impermanence, the fact that it's manifested, the fact that it came to be. It's incomprehensible to you to stop that or prevent that. It's just, it's inaccessible. The manifestation of things, the presentation of phenomena, it's just something that's completely outside of your scope. So death kind of, it's on, obviously it's on that level. It's just in this, in a general sense, if you take the phenomenon of your life, the all that happens while you're alive, well, the implication of that life is that it is, that it has come to be. It's manifested. So its cessation is implicit in its manifestation. That's what the Buddha said, like those who are unmindful, they're as if dead already. Like, you don't have to wait to die in order to be within death. All you need to do is exist within the Mara's domain, or within the domain of that which implies death. That's already as if dead, because death is there through that implication.
No. Because if you see, so if you see life, you will see its counterpart existing in the background.
Its implication.
It cannot arise without that implication of death. Life.
What do you mean cannot arise?
I mean, you know, the fact that it is manifested.
Yeah, it cannot be conceived apart, separate from.
Yeah.
It cannot be conceived without that implication, in the broadest sense of that word. So the point is, it's like, well, think of it like a simile. Say somebody is living within a waiting trap. The big trap is just waiting to crush you. You're completely unaware of the trap. You're completely unaware of the thing hanging over your head. But you have absolutely, well, by being completely unaware that it's a trap, you've absolutely no notion of escape. And even if you were to, if somebody tell you, oh, it's a trap, like you don't even know where to begin. Like you don't even recognize it. You don't even know that there is anything to be escaped or how to be escaped. That's pretty much the existence of anyone who is living within the sensual domain with the wrong view, I being Putujana. So they are as if dead already. Like, yes, technically, their life, their birth is still manifested there because they're still existing, but within the domain of the inevitable trap, inevitable cessation of that. And you can see there and then while they're in that state, by not having the right view, by not being sense restrained, you know that like they don't even know. They don't even have a notion of the escape. And as such, they might as well be dead already.
So there's the other, if you cultivate the context of death, then you cannot delight in life. You'll turn away from life. Or as it says in the sutta, upeka will be established, or the counterpart will be established, but meaning the context will be clear, death in the background, implicit. If you cultivate that,
well, there you go. Again, on the basis of the same simile, if you get the right view and you recognize the trap as a trap, you recognize that whatever has the nature of arising, that's why it's impermanent.
Yep.
Whatever has the nature to manifest, that is its impermanence. You recognize the extent of the trap. So if you then contemplate the existence of the implication of death in everything, in every in-breath, in every out-breath, as the suttas would say,
it's implicit.
If that context, and we said it before, but you know, it doesn't hurt to repeat it. The contemplation of death in the suttas that's often talked about, when he says like a monk should contemplate within an in-breath, within an out-breath, he should contemplate death. It doesn't mean he's doing it on the level. It just means that his knowledge, his correct concurrent attending to the implicit death of this life permeates even the most immediate action of breathing. So you contemplate death on the level of in-breath and out-breath, not by watching sensations of in-breath and out-breath. You contemplate it by developing that background context of the implication of that death so thoroughly that even breathing cannot remain unaffected by that context.
Yeah, even the core of life,
exactly.
The sign of life,
exactly. Even breath, the most
heartbeat,
neutral kind of habitual action that you generally take for granted. So even that will be permeated by the significance of the implication of death. And you do that not just for the sake of, you know, contemplate death so hard to reach that point where you just kind of, boom, you just step outside of it and you're free. You contemplate it so that there is a complete dispassion towards anything regarding life. And that's how you step outside of it. And that's how you're free. When there is no more passion towards that, that removes you, basically cancels you within that implication of death. So in other words, you disappear from the trap, let's put it that way, because you have no issue if a random trap falls if you are not in that trap. Like it's not your problem, cannot be your problem. So it's only a problem when you are the one who's going to be trapped or hit by that thing.
So obviously, ordinarily, everybody knows, I'm going to die. But that thought stands for something abstract in the future.
Stands for the idea of death, which is like a very much, as I said, misconceived notion of something that will happen at the end, whenever that end is, and so on, in the future with
but
the time.
But it's so disconnected from this life.
Yeah, you don't wait for, you don't, well, If you need to wait for the actual dying to contemplate death, it's too late.
Yeah.
No, you contemplate it within life, within that which was born, within that birth, within that manifestation.
But it, although people know that, they already, when they think it's at the end of my life, death is at the end, it's in the future, even if you had to cultivate that thought every day, for example, like some Stoics might have done, not that they did exactly this, but maybe at the end of their day, they might think, well, I might die tomorrow, or, you know, death is coming and so on. And they might cultivate that particular thought, abstract thought about death being in the future, not in the sense that we were talking about, but being somewhere else at some other point.
Not connected with,
it's like a different thing.
It is, yeah. They don't see it in the heart of their own present existence. Yeah.
So you, a person like that, who, if they had to somehow find the effort to do that every day, have those abstract notions of death, still might be a bit more careful.
It's better than being completely like ignorant or like deluded in regard to it. Of course, like it's better to not forget that you will die, even in that kind of abstract, secondary, remote sense that usual kind of idea of death is for people. It's better than nothing, but. Like when the Buddha was describing the contemplation of death that leads to like the quickest way of dispassion and arahantship, it has to be taken very, very differently, much more acutely, much more precisely, and much more profusely.
If you were thinking about death as an abstract thing in the future coming, and your mind becomes more grateful for the present things of life, your mind goes into the direction of delighting in life, really appreciating all the moments and all the things that can happen. I think that is a sign that you're not connecting these things.
Correct,
That's very nice.
Well, again, take the simile of the trap. See, if you're contemplating pretty much any contemplation, life, if it's done acutely, death, if it's done acutely, contemplation of a trap acutely, you recognize that, it's not something that will come later. It's right there now, as I think it, it's hanging over my head. Would you then spend time going around saying thank you to other people within the same trap and expressing your gratitude? You might say it in passing if it comes up while you are being preoccupied with how to free myself from the impending thing that's going to crush on my head in this trap.
I'm so grateful for this fate.
Like, exactly. Like, so it's even when people contemplate it, in that sense you described, those people, not everybody, but then that death is still in kind of removed. So it's like, yes, it's a trap and everything, but the fact that you think you have time to express gratitude and sort things out and appreciate things, you wouldn't appreciate stuff if you're aware of the imminent danger of that stuff. So only when that imminence is removed, you can kind of, let me deal with this, and then I'll deal with it when it comes. But it's like recognizing the imminence, the implicit
aspects. The life is the trap. The life is the death. Yeah. The death, you know, I cannot have it otherwise.
No, impossible.
But it's like the separation, because people see it separately.
Yes, the separation, so because of the accumulated wrong views.
So they don't see it simultaneously as the counterpart to life. Right there. Is surrounded, it's shell. No.
And they don't see it simultaneously because seeing things simultaneously requires training against the grain, against the directionality of your senses, of your mind, of everything you know. So you can't do it accidentally. You can't accidentally stumble upon the clear image and the relationship between life and death that would result in the immediate dispassion, you become an arahant. But you can, through repetition and through kind of digging up that way, against the grain of your senses, against the grain of life, against that flow of, you know, forward movement, so to speak, that generally is how people's lives go. So it takes that effort to swim against the current. And one of the obvious ways of doing that is taking on the precepts, celibacy, sense restraint, and then the contemplation of that like death, however remote, delayed, non-imminent might have been, it's gonna start narrowing down, because you are not maintaining the cover up of the imminence of death through your actions of sensuality, ill will, non-restraint.
You're containing sort of engagement
it.
And
you're containing, and then you're going to start discerning it on the right level.
So those who are mindful of death,
well, that's it. See, not being forgetful of that context is the beginning of that right mindfulness. That's what Buddha said. Those who are forgetful, i.e. those who are unmindful, they're as if dead already.
And only those who are mindful have an opportunity, have the...
eventually penetrate it on that acute level and understand and see it. That would then result, not as I said, in some magical, mystical experience, but in complete dispassion towards anything concerned with life. Doesn't mean they delight in death either. They just mean they contemplate it sufficiently enough to cancel out delight in life. And that's enough for liberation.
So someone gets that context of death. How do they remember it? You know, how do you keep it going throughout the day?
Oh, well, you're going to be forgetting life. It. You'll be getting distracted. You keep yourself from drifting away too far from it by policing and restraining your own actions.
Which are delighting in.
Which would be countering that context of death. See, if you're acting out of sensuality, you have to put life first. You have to put the pleasure of life even more first. Mm. And that's already a serious perversion of that actual order. And whenever you pervert the order, you cover up what's implicit in that order. So by delighting in life, by perpetuating, proliferating delight through acts of sensuality, acting out of ill will, acting out of hindrances regarding life and things that come up within that life, you are covering up the implication of death in it. And every time you cover it up, the view that death is something later gets established more and more.
And I suppose you also have to feel that threat.
Yeah.
Because it's an immediate threat. It's not.
You certainly would initially. That's why it's very important if you want to go down this route of contemplating death in similar contexts, you better have your aggregate of virtue properly established. Because otherwise the mind is just going to start freaking out in regard to everything. Because it will realize that there is no shelter up, down, above, below, behind, forward. Anything, in any direction I go to seek shelter for myself, it's under death. It's under the rule of death. It's in death, it is implicit. Thus, it's not safe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So only person that will not be overwhelmed by that is the person who already contained the mind from spilling over too far in this irrational attempt of seeking safety. That would then result in its own derangement.
Because if your aggregate of virtue is developed, then it's, even though death is that threat to life,
it can feel as a threat and everything, but it will be contained because you have contained that which is under the threat of death. So although you still have some horses in that race, so to speak, in other words, you're not completely fully dispassionate towards life, you have contained all those unwholesome ways of making your dependence on that trap even worse. So when you start recognizing the trap and that which would be destroyed by the trap, you might feel some intensity, but overall it's contained because your actions have been purified beforehand. And then you can take it further.
Mm-hmm. So a person would feel the threat and freak out only if they haven't contained that...
whatever that intensity might, at the time, might feel like the highest intensity, because it's not like you can be outside of that experience and compare it. You know, like whatever is the current pain, it's the worst pain in everyone's life. Yeah. Whatever's current worry, it's the worst worry. Yeah. But whether they're doing it rightly or not, they can see it, whether how close to the breaking the precept and acting out they are or not. Like in hindsight, when they look back a week ago when I started contemplating death and so on, yes, it felt close, it felt acute, it felt scary, but I haven't done anything on account of it. And that will already bring confidence. Because that's the measure. Have you done anything on account of it? And how bad was it? How bad did your mind make you act?
Yeah, so in the face of that felt intent, that threat, because like, well, I can think about death, I'm not afraid of death. Like many people
say. Yeah,
when I think about death, I'm not afraid of death.
It's not the death they're thinking about.
Because, when you feel a threat of pain, a little bit, what do you do?
Yeah. Well, exactly. There, sure. That's like if a person wants to start contemplating death, if they say, feel like their virtue is decent, they've been restraining, guarding the sense doors, they're not breaking the precepts, they're not engaging with sensuality, they're celibate and so on, and they want to practice, you know, a bit of a sharper approach, such as death contemplation, you don't start by your ideas of death. You just pick up something that's dear to you and imagine it being taken away. Where that feeling of pain is, that's where death is. So take it then further there. And practice dispassion towards it.
But it's also finding that those signs of death, almost, you know, picking up that flavor of death. Yeah. You know, seeing.
So imagining. It's exactly. That's what I mean. Like, so those flavors are actually to be found in things that you don't, that somebody might not necessarily associate with death, with their idea of death. They're finally not getting what you want. Being paired with what you don't want, being separated from what you want, all these things. Basically, those dukkha.
Are examples of
dukkha. Wherever there is dukkha, the direction of dukkha, that's where death is. So contemplate things that would cause you suffering. And you are contemplating death. Then you take it further and it's like, yeah, so I would be afraid. I would be affected. I would suffer if I lose the loved ones. Oh, imagine how much more then. So through that same dukkha of contemplating losing the loved ones, imagine losing also these senses on account of which you have your loved ones. Well, that's going to feel even worse.
Yeah, so imagine those things, contemplate that, but then pick up the sign of death, basically. Just pick up that.
Feel it.
Feed it.
Feel it. But as I said, only on the basis of thoroughly developed virtue, because otherwise, I mean, this is not something that the Buddha was teaching to householders.
Mm-hmm.
By householders meaning people that are not celibate, people that might occasionally take on virtue and, you know, go to monastery and keep their precept for a week or something. Like,
because for most people who
mind will not be able to
love life, love things in life, their families, their children, whatever. Getting the flavor of death, it means turning away from it and forgetting about it, never thinking about it again, and just indulging more into life. Love life even harder, because just cover it up. And if you had to give such a person the threat of death while they were still delighting so much in that life,
well, you get what the suttas describe. When they heard the Buddha describe Nibbana from their standpoint of very much cherishing life, possessions and everything else, as the Sutta described, they fell on the ground, beating their breast, pulling their hair and saying like, oh, that will kill us, that will destroy us.
Yeah, it's like people on death row in some of these in America, they're on death row, but they could be executed any day. So there's always this threat
hanging over their head. Yeah,
and they are not really wanting to be there.
Yeah.
They would rather not distract themselves from that, which they go crazy, you know.
Yeah,
it's like the worst kind of
Well, yeah, torture. that's what Dostoevsky was writing about in the House of Dead. In the prison, from his experience in the prison, basically, he saw that the worst punishment to give to a man, that, you know, a man, i.e. a householder that loves life, that does not see the problem in sensuality, is to like have a perpetual possibility of execution. Like there were people there, they were the same with their death row, and they might be killed tomorrow, they might not.
Yeah.
Sometimes they were taken out to the gallows and then sent back, and it's like unbearable mentally.
Mm.
And they all just disintegrated, and he was affected by witnessing that. Because as that other sutta describes, it's like when the man was talking to the Buddha, you brought it up recently, when it said, oh, you know, like we love life, family, sensuality, household life. Just the idea of renunciation feels like a precipice, feels like falling into the abyss. Just the idea of renunciation is like, if renunciation scares you that much, well, imagine how much forceful renunciation will scare you.
Yeah,
death.
Yes.
When things are forcefully taken away from you, when you are, when basically where your own mind does the renunciation for you, like without you wanting it, when your senses just fail. So it's like you already get the flavor through practicing renunciation. That's why it's just generally so scary. You say to people, are you sad? You got to be celibate. It's like you put on the greatest fear on them. It's like, what, forever? Like, I will never experience the pleasure of the senses again? It's like death. From the point of view of those whose minds are still very much imbued with sensuality and do not see danger in that trap.
But seeing it as danger, no longer delighting in life, which...
Yeah, so like you brought up the example of a person who, say, might experience that flavor and then double down in commitment to their life and loving life and family and so on. It's like, so if somebody experiences the flavor of death, gets a hint of it, and they recognize they're not able to like dwell on it and contemplate it rightly, at least don't cover it up twice as much as before. So allow that kind of background hint of that doubt and fear to stay there. Okay, you don't have to go fully towards it if you have not prepared the basis of virtue, sense restraint, celibacy, and so on. But at least don't cover it up.
Mm-hmm.
Don't completely cover it up. Because they were Puttujina. They were philosophers. They were religious people.
Well, they weren't so intoxicated.
Yeah, they were not withdrawn from sensuality and so on, but they did have the capacity through practice to not completely cover that up.
Mm.
And it did shape their life more wholesomely. It's not ideal because they still stay Puttujanas. But I'm saying is, if somebody who also has access to the instruction of the Dhamma and then practices that non-complete cover up of death, well, it would certainly bring you even closer to the right view. And then eventually, you might realize that giving up sensuality is not as scary as you thought it was. And you work up towards it and then actually start containing your mind on that level where it matters.
So if you do see it right, death rightly, and you start renouncing sensuality, start renouncing the world.
Well, no, you gotta start.
But yeah, you might have that in the
right,
beginning.
Don't cover it up and then start renouncing. Yeah, sure.
Then
sure,
you start,
sure. That
oh,
can
well,
be like a wake-up call, basically.
I'm going to die.
Yeah.
And there's no way I can
there,
escape
it's
that, so to speak.
Yeah.
So
how can you escape the implication of manifestation when you yourself, anything you know about yourself, any possession, any ownership is just another manifestation?
Mm.
Inconceivable.
So a person who is actually moved by that thought in the, and starts doing things rightly in accordance with it, starts to like, let me stop being a bit careful, but let me find an answer to this issue, and then starts to contemplate it more and more, and finds himself virtuous, dispassionate towards life.
Mm.
Then, as that sutta says, you know, either he is fully dispassionate towards life, or upeka gets established.
Mm, mm.
So it's not like he's in this paranoid
fear. No.
Or disgust and hates everything.
Exactly. That he might have episodes of that. But again, with the right instruction, which is abundant with the suttas and so on, you recognize, okay, no, it's about the whole dwelling on death and recollecting it and not forgetting it is just so to experience, to develop the complete dispassion towards anything concerned with life, just to that extent, not more, not less. And when that dispassion is established, you recognize, okay, so now I neither delight in that life, nor do I delight in death. I certainly don't fear it, because I have nothing to lose anymore. Whatever's here will have to not be here,
yeah,
because it's here.
Yeah.
No, for no other reason.
But seeing life, seeing it correctly, that you will see, well, when you're basically contemplating in each of their life, counterpart death.
Mm. Oh, yeah, of course.
You just, and the realization, it's not mine. This is never was mine.
Well, exactly, through this passion, because passion maintains the ownership. Acting out of passion maintains the ownership.
Mm.
Possession, consumption, all these notions, all these phenomena, it's just how you maintain the ownership.
The ownership goes.
When you realize that, when you start contemplating and establish the context that's incompatible with the growth of passion towards things, the mind just can't go in that direction because of the whole framework of death that's being seen in regard to it. Like, you go and reach this fruit to eat it easily, you enjoy it, well, then you suddenly recognize through discernment that there is a massive axe waiting to chop your hand each time you reach for the fruit. Oh, the significance, the joy of the fruit very much changes. It becomes actually dangerous. So the taste hasn't changed. It all remained the same. It still tastes the same.
Mm.
The greatest fruit ever known to man. But now you see an axe waiting to fall. And it's like, oh, it's not the same thing anymore, isn't it? So the mind will not go and just, oh, yeah, give me that fruit, let me reach for it. Because it sees what's implicit.
Mm.
And you contemplate it long enough, it will stop being scary because you recognize, well, there's nothing scary about an axe hanging over a random fruit. It becomes scary when my hand is in between the two, or my head. So now, when you recognize the danger, you don't have to, well, you have to practice sense restraint because of the habits. But when that's been thoroughly done, you don't have to then stop yourself from reaching. Just by having that context means mind will not be reaching. That's why the Buddha said, whatever you frequently think and ponder, that's what will become the inclination of your mind. So you're frequently pondering about the taste of the fruit and how great it is and the texture. Well, the mind isn't losing its broader context and it's becoming more obsessed and focused on the aspect of the taste.
The beauty.
The beauty, exactly. But if you frequently contemplate the hanging axe, well, then the mind is inclining towards avoiding that danger because it's factually dangerous. So then restraint becomes effortless. You don't need to restrain yourself because you don't want to do it in the first place.